Hey everyone, I'm excited to tell you about our newest show on the Turpentine Network called 1 to 100. 1 to 100 is a weekly deep dive with founders of notable hypergrowth companies that could be your next career move. On the upcoming season, you'll get the inside scoop on breakout companies like Modal Labs, Clay, and Mercor. You'll hear directly from the founders about how they built their products, shaped their company cultures, and scaled their businesses from 1 to 100 and beyond. If you're considering a career change or just want to stay ahead of the curve in tech, 1 to 100 will give you an edge. A link is in the description. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Econ 102, where economist Noah Smith and I make sense of what's happening in the news, technology, business, and beyond through the lens of economics. Let's jump right in.
So Noah, we're talking less than 24 hours after J.D. Vance has been nominated for VP. What do we think about this decision? Maybe a high level, how should we think about the role of a vice president or picking a vice president in general? What advice might you have had to Trump or to any of the candidate picking a VP? And how do we think about J.D. in particular?
You know, I'm not a political specialist, obviously, but my impression is that, you know, the MAGA movement or Trumpism, if you will, is a minority movement within the Republican Party, right? It's a very cohesive, powerful group of primary voters within the Republican Party. But in terms of an actual movement with, you know, intellectuals and elites and a whole bunch of elected officials who sort of vote that way and you know, support Trump's peculiar mix of kind of non-standard Republican priorities, it's pretty thin. Like the bench is pretty thin. You know, you've got, and most of them are disreputable people who you know, aren't really credible as national politicians, like, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, like people like that, or Matt Gaetz, right? Like these people kind of suck. And you know, even Republicans just know that they suck. They knifed Madison Cawthorn because he was too sucky. And a lot of, you know, kind of grifters and people attach themselves. And then there's people like, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, who he's not a politician, right? He's sort of this outside figure who kind of sort of tried to meme himself into being a politician. But, you know, the only reason he's gotten that much attention is because there's such an absolute dearth of people within the Republican Party who are real Trumpists, you know. And J.D. Vance was the most solid, credible Trumpist. You know, he said a lot of mean things about Trump in the past. He said Trump is the next Hitler. He said a lot of really mean things about Trump. But then he pivoted hard to be sort of like Trump's closest ideological adherent and ally. And then there's Josh Hawley, who tries to do kind of the same thing. Those are kind of the most, there's no Trumpist governors out there. There's conservative governors like DeSantis or Abbott. There's no Trumpist governors. There are, you know, Josh Hawley and J.D. Vance are easily the two most prominent Trumpist politicians in the country besides Trump. And, you know, J.D. Vance, neither Josh Hawley nor J.D. Vance is like an incredibly popular, charismatic person, but J.D. Vance is a lot more political savvy. Hawley is a, you know, he's a bit of a wimp. I don't know. He ran away from the January 6th people, like physically ran away. So Vance it is, you know, like he's the, even though he said all these mean things about Trump, he's the one like young, you know, prominent elected official who Trump can really name to be the VP. So there's really no one else here. And I think that's my impression. But, you know, like I said, not an expert.
Yeah. I heard someone say that Youngkin would have been a better pick kind of for the map or for election chances or kind of to round it out, but that Vance picks symbolize kind of a fuck it, we ride, you know, sort of double down on momentum. And I heard other people sort of have the perspective of, hey, Vance represents a younger, more tech forward. You know, of course, he was, you know, picked by Thiel or backed by Thiel early on. So sort of the Silicon Valley right is happy about that. He's of course a venture capitalist. So
I met him at the Hill and Valley Forum.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, it's interesting because he's both a venture capitalist, but he also has sort of this like, I don't know, working class cred or working class kind of aesthetic, you know, having grown up the way he did. And
it was interesting that he definitely seemed the most uncomfortable person in the room talking to a bunch of tech people. Like he seemed like he was a bit uncomfortable, which is not a knock on him. You know, I mean, like if like those tech people are kind of weird. And so, but I, you know, And I did have an interesting brief conversation with him. I think he's a smart guy. You know, because Vance has shifted so much over the last few years, we don't really know exactly what his policy positions are. I think it's fair to say that he's in favor of regional economic development because, you know, his whole political career came from being mad that, you know, the hillbillies had been left behind, right? That's his book. And that's his idea. As someone with hillbilly cousins on both sides of the family, I understand, you know. It's interesting. You don't necessarily think of hillbillies as being like a stereotypical Jewish sort of culture or, you know, thing. But on both sides of my family, I have people who, as soon as they got from Europe to America, they immediately moved to the Ozarks and became farmers. And, I understand that. That's regional economic development was sort of a theme of a thing people were talking about in 2016, 2017, after Trump's first victory. You know, and so I think that he's going to prioritize that. He said basically Elbridge Colby type stuff about shifting resources from Europe to Asia. And I agree with that in terms of the idea. Whether they'll actually do that, we don't know yet, because they might just shift resources away from Europe and then not send resources to Asia, not try to resuscitate the defense industrial base, not try to bolster Taiwan and Philippines and these allies in Asia. And so they might just be using, you know, withdrawal from Europe and withdrawal of support from Ukraine as an excuse to basically be isolationist instead of, you know, or I'm saying using the idea of pivoting to Asia as an excuse to be isolationist, and then they won't actually pivot to Asia because, you know, basically Trump will get bought out by the CCP. I think that's a reasonably likely outcome of what we're looking at now. I'm going to write a column about that soon. But it could also be that won't happen. You know, I think that people like Elbridge Colby really want to oppose China or Robert O'Brien and some of these people. They want what, you know, of course, Trump is the big man and what he decides will rule. And I think that he's a venal and corrupt man who can be easily bought, as the TikTok episode shows. And so I'm not very confident that they'll actually execute the pivot to Asia, but I think Vance would like to do it. Vance has also talked about devaluing the dollar. A lot of people talk about this, and it'll never happen because nobody really has a good idea how to do it. I do, and they could call me up, and I could tell them how to do this. But they won't call me up because I'm a lib, and they don't call libs up because we might just be concern trolls doing sneaky Trojan horses to undermine their whole thing, worming our way into their, you know, thoughts or whatever. So they won't call me up. But I do know how to do it. And so I think that, you know, Vance is the most industrial policy supporting, you know, Republican politician, except for, you know, Hawley. Vance is, you know, in terms of defense manufacturing, in terms of supporting, you know, left behind regions, basically in terms of activist intervention in the economy for those purposes. I think Vance is the guy, you know, and so that's good because, you know, it heralds that there's the possibility that with a guy like Vance in charge of the you know, GOP policy, there's a possibility that the GOP might do the things that I think the nation, Democratic or Republican, needs to do. You know, so there's a possibility we might revive manufacturing and pivot to China, pivot to, you know, blocking China in Asia. We might do that. There's a chance that Vance talks that game, and it's not clear. I mean, the vice president doesn't really have that much power. Look at Kamala Harris. You know, look at any vice president. They don't have much power. So there's a question of how much Vance will set the agenda in the next few years. I'm pessimistic. I think that the next few years will probably be mostly defined by Trump's personal recriminations and feuds. I think that will distract us both from Asia, from economics, from everything. But the idea that, you know, Vance could in some sense represent an intellectual shift in the Republican Party toward industrial policy, you know, and toward putting Asia first, that those would both be good things. So I'm you know, I don't think any vice president does much of anything. But I think that the fact that Vance supports those things is a good sign. And so I'm, you know, like, I would prefer that they pick Vance, you know, simply because he wants some of the same things I do. But again, you know, I'm a lib. So like on cultural, social issues, whatever, we'd be very opposed. And so, well, I don't know. We'll see. But because, you know, I don't know his idea on cultural issues. Certainly, I think. Anyway, so I'm optimistic about this choice, actually.
This is actually a good segue because, and we got a question on it. Last week, we went over the Trump's sort of, you know, policy sort of plan or proposal, and we stopped, or we didn't get to finish with foreign policy. That's the last one we didn't get to. And so maybe we can segue to, you just mentioned, hey, you're worried that Trump's personal sort of recriminations will lead to a distraction in Asia. If you could outline your Asia first policy, if you can wave a wand and we do anything regarding Asia that you recommend, what would those steps be exactly?
So on military stuff, we've got to, you know, we've obviously got to produce a lot more stuff. We've got to increase defense spending a lot right now, because these are the, you know, we're doing a decent amount of modernization. So Hal Brands is the guy to talk to on this. The United States is doing a decent amount of modernization. China has come up with a whole bunch of stuff that can kick our ass. We have come up with stuff that will kick the ass of that stuff. That stuff is in the pipeline, will be rolled out around 2030, right? So it'll be about 6 years from now that stuff will start, you know, entering use, and our transformation into a force oriented toward fighting China and denying China conquest in the Pacific Ocean will be, you know, well underway in 2030. But it is not 2030 yet. And so in the meantime, what we have to do is buy a whole bunch of missiles. Like, buy missiles and drones. And, you know, of course, develop a few things like look at Ukraine to figure out how to do electronic warfare, because electronic warfare is proving very important with these precision munitions, with drones, all this stuff. And so we need to buy a lot of these missiles. We don't have very many missiles. China has a lot of missiles, and China can make more missiles very rapidly. So we need to massively increase our missile production, and also our drone production, our artillery production, but mostly, most importantly, missiles. Missiles. We need that. And so we need a large increase in defense spending right now to do that. Will we get that under Trump? I am not optimistic that we will. The second thing we need to do is integrate our military better and our defense industrial base better with Japan, you know, with Korea, because North Korea may also, you know, jump in and attack, you know, and then if possible with India, right? We need to pump up these alliances, right? With Australia, of course. We need to pump up these alliances, especially Japan and India. And do I see Trump doing that? No, but maybe, you know, you never quite know what he's going to do, because predicting that Trump will or won't do something hasn't worked out, you know, super well for me. Because I predicted that he would basically flub the vaccine effort, and then it went really well. You know, like, it went very well, successfully. And great industrial policy right there. In the clutch, really came through. And so also, I didn't predict that Trump would mail everybody massive checks to get them through COVID, and yet he did. Because, you know, and so in both those cases, it was because he outsourced the policies to competent subordinates while he primarily spent his time yelling at people he didn't like. And the things worked. And so what will happen this time? I can't say. Maybe he will outsource China policy, defense policy, all this stuff to competent subordinates. I'm not optimistic about Congress increasing defense spending. But if Republicans have Congress, there's more of a chance that they will, you know, cut the growth of healthcare spending and increase defense spending. Basically, we throw all this money into healthcare, and we need to put more money in defense. Am I a Republican for saying that? Well, no, I would be in 1983, right? I would be in 1983 if I said, you know, well, we ought to spend less on welfare and more on defense. Then I would have been a Republican at that point for saying that, or that would have been a very Republican thing to say. But now it's not clear whether that's what the Republicans want. Do Republicans actually, I mean, I guess the Republicans want to cut Medicaid, which is like healthcare for the poor, which is the meanest part of healthcare to cut. But you know what? They want to cut it. But I don't see any appetite for increasing defense spending on the Republican side. And that needs to change really fast. We're in big danger. So those are some of the things we need to do immediately. In the longer term, obviously, military modernization, we're already working on it. We need to fund it more. Industrial policy, so we have a, you know, rebuild the defense industrial base, but also make sure we maintain a presence in, you know, essentially semiconductor computer chips and drones, because that's the name of the game, right, in terms of modern warfare. So we need to maintain or get leads in those areas. Those have to be the focus of our industrial policy. Basically, yeah, computer chips and drones, dude. And so that's what we need to do. Will we do it? You know, your guess is as good as mine at this point.
Quick side note, how do you explain that transition, what you mentioned, you know, sort of the Republican view in 1983 is perhaps now the Democrat view. Is it because the makeup of the party shifted, where, you know, Republican adopted much of the working class due to education polarization, or is there some other better explanation to understand why the, you know, Democrats have more favored defense here?
Yeah, Trump is a big shift. Trump represents a big shift on, you know, entitlement spending. Republicans fought against entitlement spending for a long time, and their main target was Social Security, which is actually that's the one you don't want to go after. Like, Social Security has a big deficit. You can fix Social Security by raising the retirement age and by lowering the growth of benefits until, you know, you can fine tune it so that it's stable, because ultimately the defining feature of Social Security is that people get out just about what they put in to Social Security. It's always possible to have a system where people get out what they put in that's sustainable. That's just by definition sustainable, as long as you make sure that, you know, you balance things so that money out equals money in. It's not too hard to fix Social Security. And we need to do it, and I hope we do, but that's not too hard. The thing is that healthcare spending has a couple of problems. Number one, it's highly redistributive. So the people who are getting the benefit of healthcare aren't the government healthcare spending are typically not the people who are paying for it. But Republicans, you know, as they've shifted toward sort of low education seniors as their base, they have, you know, they've shifted to a keep your government hands off my Medicare attitude. And so, you know, if they're going to restrain the growth of health spending, it's going to be difficult with that orientation. In addition, which is why they focus on Medicaid instead, because that's like poor people who don't vote. Honestly, probably they're hitting some of their own voters there too, but they've been had a lot of antipathy toward Medicaid. So it's not it's not the nicest way to fund, like cutting healthcare for poor people so that you can build up your military is not necessarily the way I'd do it. But it's a thing Republicans might do. Raising taxes, we really should do. Republicans don't want that. But it is a thing we need to do. And, you know, they do not have they don't want to do that. They don't want to raise taxes. I mean, increasingly, Democrats don't want to raise taxes either. One problem is that we've reached this negative political equilibrium where neither party wants to raise taxes and neither party wants to cut spending. So the fuck do you do? And both parties want maximum social spending and minimum taxes. And so what do? You can't, you know, you can't fund a defense buildup. You can't even stop the deficit, you know, from swamping us with interest costs. Like, so it's the sign of a extreme dysfunction. I think for years we had this sort of one-legged stool where, you know, Democrats were holding it down all on their own. Democrats are the ones who did austerity in the Clinton years. And even in the later Obama years, Democrats did austerity. And then Republicans let the Democrats take the political hit for that. The Democrats finally got tired of it and said, you know what? Raising taxes, that's no longer our thing. Sorry, guys. You know, and restraining spending growth, good luck. You know, you do it. And Republicans are like, no, you do it. And Democrats are like, no, you do it. And so the point is that nobody's going to stand up and do it. I'm not optimistic about Trump making hard decisions because he's a populist. You know, he didn't even withdraw from Afghanistan. We obviously should have done that. He waited and let Biden take the political hit for it, which he did. So we don't have leadership. We don't have anyone willing to stand up and take the political hit for, you know, deficit reduction, tax hikes, social spending restraint. And so that, you know, that worries me.
A segue to a question by Jacob. Is it fair to say that Biden has been a continuation of Trumpism in the areas of China policy and energy policy, and a departure from Trump's policy positions as it relates to immigration and Ukraine? Or is there a different way of thinking about the differences or similar or overlaps between their policy positions?
Okay, so that's interesting. On China, yes, Biden has been a continuation and an enhancement of Trump's China policies. Biden has kept the tariffs, increased tariffs more than Trump did. He's kept export controls, increased export controls a lot more than Trump did. And basically, you know, mounted this vigorous, you know, rhetorical defense of Taiwan, although Biden unfortunately backed off of some of this after his meeting with Xi in San Francisco. So, but Biden has been, you know, basically continued Trump's China policies. Biden also, so he mentioned the question mentioned immigration as a place where Biden's changed Trump policies. Well, he did to start with, but he has basically gone back to Trump's policies in the last year. So because unfortunately, our asylum system's broken until we fix that. The asylum spammers are still going to come and illegally cross the border and turn themselves into the border patrol and request asylum because they can get away with it, because that works. And as long as that works, you know, things like border security and remain in Mexico and all these things are just patches. And Trump did the patches. A lot of them got struck down by the courts. Biden just took them all away and ignored the border for years, thinking that COVID would take care of the situation. It didn't. The border flood came back even bigger than before. And so then Biden belatedly overrode the political pressure groups within the Democratic Party and re-implemented Trump-style border controls. But even those are still just a patch. The courts will strike them down. And they tamp down the problem a little bit, but they don't really fix the problem. The problem will only be fixed once you fix asylum law. Close the asylum loophole. No one's talking about doing that. But anyway, but Biden did go back to Trump's policies on that. On Ukraine, the Ukraine war happened in 2022. There was a low-level Ukraine war going on before that. Russia was supporting separatists and fighting Ukraine a little bit, before 2022. And Trump, but under Trump, we actually did, so the Ukrainian army did really, really well in this war, right? They did much better than anyone thought. Ukraine is a much poorer country than Russia, and they're a much smaller country than Russia. But yet they managed to hold off the Russian army in a straight up one-to-one fight. They had, foreign arms, of course, but they had a lot of foreign training. And a lot of that training happened under Trump. Obama did start that after the 2014, invasion of Crimea and the Donbass. But a lot of it was continued under Trump. Trump did, the United States Army trained the Ukrainian army while Trump was president. So that happened. Everyone says Trump is buddies with Putin. That may be true. I think it's more the case that Putin thinks that Trump is a chaos agent and then electing Trump will be advantageous to Putin. I think that despite that, we haven't really seen a comparable, comparison on the Ukraine policy. I do think there'll be a big difference now, but I think that we didn't see that much departure. So Biden actually did change Trump's energy policy. So Biden came in saying he was going to ban fracking. You stop all this, drilling for shale oil, right? He didn't. At first, it looked like he might. Then the Ukraine war happened, and then, oil supplies became tight and inflation soared. And so at that point, what you do is you drill as much as you can. So Biden did. The United States drills more oil under Biden than under Trump. And so Biden opened up record amounts of land for oil drilling. Biden is even more of a pro-oil president than Trump was. So in that sense, he continued Trump's policies and even enhanced them, just like with China. The big departure is that Biden did the Inflation Reduction Act, which gave huge, huge subsidies to green energy and, especially electric vehicles and solar power, but also some other stuff. And that was a big departure. And Trump will try to cancel that, which is stupid. I hate that this has become political football, because energy is energy and we should want cheap energy. So Biden has continued Trump's policies on fossil fuels, but had a radical departure about green energy and for the promotion of green energy.
Hey, everybody. Eric here with a word from our sponsor. Fast forward to the end of 2024. Think about your goals. What can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If learning a new language is on your list, you absolutely need to check out Babbel. Babbel offers a range of learning tools, self-study app lessons, live classes, and even podcasts, which have always been my favorite way to learn. Studies from Yale, Michigan State University, and others continue to prove Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Babbel isn't just a game to kill time and make you feel like you're learning a language. It's not overly academic or rigid either. It's all about learning language for the real world. Babbel stands out because it's designed by real people using a modern conversational teaching approach. It's not always easy, nothing worth doing ever is, but it's straightforward and designed to help you start speaking in just 3 weeks. With Babbel, I was able to brush up on my intermediate Spanish to ramp up for travel to Argentina last year, and was able to set clear goals based on how much time each week I wanted to practice. Join millions of Babbel language learners across all age groups. Here's a special limited time offer for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/econ102. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/econ102, spelled babbel.com/econ102. Rules and restrictions may apply. If you don't already subscribe to Turpentine's industry-leading newsletters, like our new daily AI newsletter, Emergent Behavior, or Media Empires, you should. But that's not what I'm here to tell you about. The platform we use to power these newsletters is called Beehive, and it's excellent. First of all, it was started by the same early team who helped build Morning Brew into a $75 million newsletter business. And they built Beehive to offer that same powerful functionality to anyone sending emails. From essayists to business owners, the platform is beautiful, their text editor is intuitive, and they help you scale your audience with custom growth features. Beehive has powerful tools to help you monetize your content. You can easily launch paid subscriptions or pursue an advertising model. The Beehive platform will even connect you to premium brands to sponsor your newsletter. Not only do we use them, but thousands of the top newsletters in the world also use them, like Milk Road, Blockworks, the Lindy Newsletter, and so many more. Beehive's founder hooked up Moment of Zen listeners with a sweet deal. Get 20% off for 3 months with code MOZ. Visit beehive.com, that's BEEHIIV.com, to get started.
Is there anything that, if you think Trump gets elected, or anything else, or what else will he try to either cancel or change immediately from the Biden era? Or, you know, to ask the question in a slightly different way, if Trump had won a second term, and we had the last 4 years with the Trump presidency, what substantively policy-wise or approach to foreign policy besides China might be different, do you think?
Well, so it's hard to answer that because it's hard to answer whether Trump would have changed his own stuff. You know, I can't just say, well, here's what he did in the first term. He would have done the exact same thing in the second term. It's hard to know, right? And so I will say Trump created a paradigm shift in policy and Biden deepened and enhanced that paradigm shift. Much in the same way that Reagan, you know, shifted us toward more free market, you know, quote unquote neoliberal policies, but the substantive stuff of that was mostly done by Bill Clinton, you know, or you know the FDR changed us to the New Deal, and much of the substance of the New Deal was implemented by Eisenhower and Nixon, Republicans. So it's happened before, and so I think that you saw much more policy continuity on some of these things. Whether Trump will actually have continuity with his own stuff this time around, I'd say, is something we still don't know.
By the way, Andreessen Horowitz this morning just came out in support of Trump. That, you know, going, we discussed a few weeks ago of Silicon Valley's, you know, moving towards Trump, and that seems to have escalated. You know, Elon donating $45 million a month to a super PAC. A16Z just came out in support of Trump, or donating to Trump, and their reasoning was purely on the little tech agenda. I just, for AI and crypto, they think the Trump sort of you know, platform is more friendly. At the same time, you know, Reid Hoffman and others are still sort of, you know, representing the faction of Silicon Valley that is, you know, a never Trump or anti Trump or pro Biden. And of course, the Democrats still need to figure out whether, you know, Biden is the candidate and if there's another one. But any other reactions to any of this?
Well, I mean, so Biden, a couple things happened. You know, Biden, of course, the administration really pissed off the tech industry. They went after big tech companies, not little tech, right? Biden didn't go after startups. He didn't try to shut down the venture capital industry or whatever. But they did go after, you know, Google and all these companies. And every little tech company, its valuation is based on the chance of it becoming a big tech company. Right. And if your win case means getting sued by Lina Khan, you know, if that's your victory condition, that hurts, you know, hurting big tech can hurt little tech too, by sort of, you know, iterated expectation. Right. You see forward to your future and you're like, okay, if we win, then they come after us and try to destroy us. And so that, you know, I think that helped turn little tech as well as big tech, you know, sour them on Biden. Also, Gary Gensler is very harsh on crypto. And of course, crypto's valuation is entirely driven by crypto adoption. And so Gary Gensler being against crypto holds back its adoption and limits the personal wealth gains of people who hold a bunch of Bitcoin and Ether. And so that, I think that, you know, everyone I talked to in tech who said mean things about Biden mentioned crypto. Crypto became an interest group. It's less a technology than it is an interest group. It's just a way to funnel money directly to people in tech. And Biden's administration didn't realize that and didn't take advantage of that. And so Trump does, and we'll pump the crypto bag. And so that's a no-brainer. But I think, you know, on top of all that, I think there's an element of people trying to attach themselves to power here. They know Trump's going to win. When you know someone's going to win, you don't piss them off and say, well, I support the other guy who's definitely going to lose, right? Like, just being a non-dumbass 101. Like, yeah, at that point, if you support, you know, if you keep supporting Biden knowing he's going to lose just because of a principled stand, well, you're be a principled fellow. But like, you know, if you're a principled fellow, why did you go into business and try to make all this money in the first place? Like, if your main thing was like morality, yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, business people have morals. It's just that they also have pocketbooks.
It's interesting. Some people are saying you don't want to switch the candidate because if you switch the candidate, you set them up for failure in the long term. And so you might, if you think there's a low chance of winning, you might as well just put Biden. Is that true that if you were to get a new candidate, Newsom or, you know, whoever, that, and if they lose, that would set them up for failure in future?
I mean, yeah, but like if you sub in Kamala Harris, she'll lose to Trump. And then I think you should do this because you get to get rid of Kamala Harris. She's not charismatic. She represents, you know, whether or not she upholds them, she cares about them herself to the electorate. She represents, you know, sort of ideas that are not very conducive to winning elections. And so you want to, and she's personally uncharismatic as well. She's kind of a Hillary Clinton-esque weather vane social climber type of person.
And the ideas are the progressive left ideas, like the far left ideas, or which ideas are you referring to?
I would say, you know, woke stuff. Like Kamala Harris is the candidate that most represents wokeness to people. You know, she's not that popular among Black voters, despite being part Black herself. She's very popular with like educated, suburban, nice white ladies, you know, progressive white ladies who think they'd like to support a Black candidate. And ultimately that's not, you know, yeah, those people are influential within the Democratic Party and can be an important base for turnout, the nice white progressive ladies from the suburbs. But, you know, ultimately they're in the minority about this. They're wrong about this. You know, they're people like Kamala Harris is not the future. And, you know, she can lose now or lose later. I honestly think that if they run her now, she loses. If they wait to 2028, it'll, you know, and run Biden, basically sacrifice him. He's old anyway. Doesn't matter. Sacrifice him and then come back in 2028 and have a big open primary and a big fight. I think she loses. I think she does not win that. I think that it's possible Gavin Newsom wins. It's possible Gretchen Whitmer wins. It's possible some, like, you know, a dark horse candidate wins. I think that she'll probably lose anyway. But running her now and having her lose to Trump right now would be a better way of broadcasting that the party has made a decisive break with the woke era, which will help them win elections.
Is there a candidate out there, someone like a Mark Cuban, or, you know, someone who has the money or access to money and has enough name recognition to actually run against Trump and have a much better chance of winning?
The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. No, I have no idea.
Cuban himself?
Michelle Obama is the only one.
Oh, Michelle Obama.
So you could, if you can just suddenly sub in Michelle Obama, maybe. I would like that. I would do it because that's the only way she's ever going to be a politician. She doesn't want to be president. She has no interest in doing that. But I think that would be a cool move if she did want to do it, if you could do it. You know, wife of a beloved former leader is a very popular way. Like that's a successful kind of leader in many cases, you know, from like Argentina does that all the time. But you also have that. You have that in a lot of countries. Wife of beloved former leader becomes leader herself. It's a common story. And so I, you know, if Michelle Obama would do it, you'd probably sub her in. Maybe you'd have a chance of winning. She's also just, I like Michelle Obama a lot. She's great. She's super charismatic. She's, you know, smart. She, you know, I mean, Kamala Harris is smart, but she's a wonk. She's a nerd. She's someone who studies for a test. Whereas Michelle Obama is pragmatic and can, you know, like Michelle Obama is everything Kamala Harris is not. And she would massively appeal to minority voters, unlike Kamala.
It is interesting. If you were to ask who is the Democrat version of Trump, I think it's not crazy to say Mark Cuban, right? He himself is populist, you know, owning NBA teams. He had his own version of The Apprentice. Him and Trump have been in feuds for, you know, for decades. Does he just have no chance?
I don't know. I don't think he's going to run. I don't think Mark Cuban wants to be a politician. I think like Reid Hoffman or Mark Benioff or, you know, Peter Thiel, or any of these guys, you know, he wants to stay on the sideline and yell about how he thinks the world should be as he swims in his giant swimming pool of money.
Yes, exactly.
I put radio on the internet. Remember that guy?
Yeah.
That's supposed to be Mark Cuban, right?
Yeah.
He's like, yeah. I put radio on the internet. And then you become a billionaire because if you're in the 90s, putting radio on the internet's a big deal. I mean, I guess it was TV put on the internet. But yeah, so that was... Anyway, can I slightly rant? I mean, I know you love when I rant. The Democrats have lost their... So even as the tech industry went, you know, increasingly woke, Democrats have lost their love of the idea of technology. Democrats will still support green tech, you know, but that's become almost the only kind of tech that Democrats will support. I mean, there's the CHIPS Act, but that's bipartisan. And I wouldn't say your average progressive gives a shit about it. It's a great policy, but, you know, and Biden was great to do it. I hope the Republicans don't cancel it, but I would say that your average progressive doesn't care about it. It's not a cause celeb, you know what I mean? But green tech is, it's the only kind of technology. Democrats, you know, progressives, not Democrats, progressives have embraced this idea that essentially tech is bad. Industrial society, you know, it's the 70s idea of industrial society destroys our world. And the only good tech, is, you know, maybe, unless you're a degrowth or socialist, whatever, in which case you hate all tech. But, you know, to your standard progressive now, the only good tech is tech that makes us more sustainable, is environmental tech that in some sense they can think of as undoing the harms of previous tech, which they think have ruined the world. And so, you know, that's in some ways not wrong. I mean, obviously fossil fuels didn't ruin the world, but they have negative side effects and green tech does fix that. So that's, they're not wrong in that case, but they think of like IT and, you know, a lot of advanced manufacturing and, you know, defense tech or robotics, robots taking everyone's jobs. Machine tools are bad, they take everyone's jobs. Computers are bad, they take everyone's jobs. You know, IT is bad. It just allows billionaires to control us, man. And so they've lost respect for almost every kind of technology in society. To call yourself a progressive while being anti-technology is dumb. And, you know, this has been a big problem. The progressive movement becoming anti-tech, anti-everything except green tech, is a problem we don't talk much about. But that's ultimately a big part of the reason why you see tech people who are liberal on all these social values shifting to the Republican Party, because, you know, if someone bashes you enough, you're going to stop supporting them after a while.
Yeah. Someone tweeted that last night that the Democrats made a big mistake in alienating Elon. You know, Elon was a Democrat, right? Now he's donating a lot of money, and but much more importantly, he's, you know, bought Twitter, renamed it X, and made it, you know, much more of a right-wing sympathetic platform.
Well, yeah, I don't know if, I mean, did Democrats intentionally alienate Elon Musk? Well, I think it was probably more reactive, because Elon Musk does green tech. He, you know, Democrats love electric cars. You know, and the only reason why they stopped mentioning Elon as like this awesome dude all the time was because he became a Republican. I think Elon became a Republican on his own.
Yeah, let's trace his evolution. I'm trying to remember. I mean, I think San Francisco was giving him issues. There was a famous government employee or something who said, get out, like, anti-billionaire rhetoric or something.
A bunch of lefty lawyers sued him for various reasons. At some party, I met some guy who was like, I'm suing Elon Musk right now for being a racist. I was like, okay, good job. Then maybe we can get rid of those pesky electric cars and everyone will be happy. Fuck you. Anyway, great. But the point is that, like, people went after Elon Musk because it was a time of unrest. And we had a time of unrest on the right and the left at the same time. That's unusual. That was why this time of unrest was quite bad politically, because the right and the left went nuts at the same time. You know, in the 1970s, you had lots of left unrest. And some of it, you know, when I say went nuts, I don't mean that necessarily that their causes were bad. Much of the, you know, some of the things that people in the 60s and 70s wanted that on the left were good, very good. Ending the Vietnam War or, you know, like whatever. But then some things were dumb. You know, like, we don't have to relitigate the 70s, but there was lots of dumb stuff too. There was, you know, smart stuff and dumb stuff in that movement. But the basically the right in the 70s and 80s was a status quo power. They were the conservatives. They just wanted to keep stuff kind of the same, you know, and then the left wanted to change things. And I think we arrived at a good synthesis, whereas, you know, 80s, 90s and early 2000s, America was pretty good during those times. We arrived at a synthesis in the 1910s and 20s. The right got really wild. You had the KKK marching in Washington with over a million people and taking over, like, you know, entire towns. You had the America First movement. You had various, like, you know, anti-immigration stuff. The you know, and you had race riots. You had the right, you know, rightist, basically, like, just racist people, like, burning, destroying black neighborhoods throughout America in the, you know, right after World War One and the years after World War One. Tulsa is the one everybody knows about, where they, because they got some bombers out of a hangar and actually bombed a black neighborhood. So everyone knows about Tulsa, and they had this place, Black Wall Street, that got destroyed. That was one of about 200 of those, you know, that, like, that happened all over the country. So that was that era. And, you know, there were progressives, but they were like reformers. They were socialists, but they were reasonably moderate, you know, socialists like Eugene Debs, right? They wanted rights for workers and stuff like that. They weren't like revolutionary communists. The revolutionary communists tried to get toeholds in our socialist movement and they failed. And so the progressives and socialists were actually, the left was reasonable as heck. And that ended up translating to the New Deal, most of whose, you know, changes to our country we don't want to go back on. Even Republicans don't really want to go back on. And so the left was reasonable in the early 20th century. And then the right was more reasonable in the late 20th century, or at least, you know, if not more reasonable, at least calmer. You know, basically, one side was on offense and the other side was on defense. But in the 2010s, you saw both sides on offense. Progressives were less likely to, you know, kill people and whatever. But they, you know, there were riots. Stuff did get burned in 2020. And there were street battles, you know, Antifa, you know. I kind of like Antifa. I like those guys. You'd like them too if you met them. They don't necessarily have the smartest political ideas. Why? Because they're just a bunch of like Gen X punks. Because they're just, you know, they're just a bunch of punk rockers who are like, I'm going to go out and beat up some Nazis. I support that, you know, but at the same time, they don't have a very accurate worldview when it comes to like policy and politics and the anarchy that they support. They're all anarchists, right? Like, the anarchy that they support, the West Coast anarchists, the anarchy they support has been really bad for businesses, for, you know, poor people in the West Coast. And so shitty, likable people with shitty politics, you know. But there was that. But more importantly, the whole woke era, right, in the 2010s, was a lot of it became very radical. You know, this idea that we should have anti-white discrimination at every level of society in order to remedy structural white supremacy is the idea of Ibram Kendi. You know, Ibram Kendi talks about anti-racism, not in the sense of getting rid of racism, but in the sense of anti-matter to matter. You know, it's like, it's just racism with the opposite sign. And so, you know, it's like, for many years, progressives, Democrats would say, reverse racism isn't a thing. Well, Kendi's like, okay, I'm going to make it a thing. And he did. And so, and then I think that became, we never created a constitutional amendment with a department of anti-racism to just peer into every corner of society and adjust everything in society like Kendi wanted. It was this insane totalitarian shit. But I would say that DEI is the actually operationalized version of Kendiism, where, you know, HR people in every company and or like people on every school board and every university think, okay, it's my mission to fight structural white supremacy by hiring different people, by racially discriminating. And the pushback against that will be long and fierce, because Americans like some degree of tacit racial discrimination, but they do not like explicit racial discrimination being the foundation of our society. So people are going to push back. And so DEI will be basically doing guerrilla warfare for the next 10 years. It'll be like people will be quietly doing DEI within corporations, hoping they don't get sued, instead of publicly, brazenly advertising how much DEI they do. So, you know, that's going to be a big pushback. And that was extreme. That was radical. Even if it wasn't always, you know, like motivated by violence, it's still a radical, extreme idea. And at the same time, you have the right becoming extreme with the turn against immigration, with sort of the return. You just saw a lot of old rightist ideologies crop up You saw like Mencius Moldbug. I don't know. But then you also saw the alt-right. You saw the Proud Boys fighting Antifa in the streets. That was the, you know, you saw the rise of some more radical militias, especially the Oath Keepers were the most radical militia. You saw some stochastic terrorism. You saw, for example, some people trying to bomb some Democrats, letter bomb some Democrats. You saw some synagogue shootings. You saw some shootings of immigrants. You saw some shootings of Black people. So you saw some of this stuff, you know, and so there was radicalism of different kinds, but on both sides. And so both sides went on offense at the same time. And the last time you saw that was before the Civil War. You saw radical abolitionists, who of course I agree with, but you know, you saw John Brown cut people's head off with a sword. Like he chopped people's head off with a broadsword for being slavers. And we can say, yeah, John Brown, kill him. But like, it is extreme. You're violent. We also saw extreme, you know, radicalism by the pro-slavery people in the years before the Civil War. They would just ride up into northern states, terrorize the local populace, ostensibly looking for slaves. And sometimes they would find the, you know, fugitive slaves. But then, you know, they'd also just like rape people, just do the border ruffians, right? Like, you didn't talk about it as much. They would say like, and they insulted our women. That means you raped them. That means you raped some farm wives in Iowa because you're galloping. We're looking for slaves, you know, like, and then they just rape people. Like, so they sucked. And like, but you know, the radical abolitionists, they got guns and just started shooting people in like Kansas. And you know, so and there was bleeding Kansas, right? You had the wide awakes, the people who pretty much invented the term woke, you know, which were a bunch of white guys in like northern cities marching through the cities with masks on, you know, with torches. And like, you know, threatening to burn shit. And then, and of course, these competing passions led to an actual civil war, which drew in many of the people who weren't part of the extremists in the first place. Now, I happen to agree with one side of the extremists and disagree with the other side in that case. But there's no denying that the passions were there. And so I don't think we're going to have a civil war. But I think that the fact that this age of unrest has been so sort of uniquely damaging to us has a lot to do with the fact that the right and left got activated at the same time for the first time in 150 years.
Hey, everybody. Eric here with a word from our sponsor. Fast forward to the end of 2024. Think about your goals. What can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If learning a new language is on your list, you absolutely need to check out Babbel. Babbel offers a range of learning tools, self-study app lessons, live classes, and even podcasts, which have always been my favorite way to learn. Studies from Yale, Michigan State University, and others continue to prove Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Babbel isn't just a game to kill time and make you feel like you're learning a language. It's not overly academic or rigid either. It's all about learning language for the real world. Babbel stands out because it's designed by real people using a modern conversational teaching approach. It's not always easy. Nothing worth doing ever is, but it's straightforward and designed to help you start speaking in just 3 weeks. With Babbel, I was able to brush up on my intermediate Spanish to ramp up for travel to Argentina last year and was able to set clear goals based on how much time each week I wanted to practice. Join millions of Babbel language learners across all age groups. Here's a special limited time offer for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only at babbel.com/Torenberg. That's babbel.com/Torenberg, spelled BABBEL.com/Torenberg. Rules and restrictions may apply. Today, I want to make a bit of a personal appeal to anyone working on a SaaS app or website. If you spend any time on the internet, you probably have interacted with chatbots in the bottom right corner of sites. Most are really annoying. AI is making them better, but still I often just get really useless generic answers out of these and end up just wanting to talk to a real human. It felt to me like AI shouldn't just make chatbots marginally better at text responses, but that they should enable a new type of web assistant, something that feels like you're talking to a human support agent who is co-browsing alongside you. Command Bar is building that user assistant. Companies embed it into their web app, mobile app, or website, and they get a fully generative chatbot that can give personalized responses that refer to a user's past chats, perform actions directly on behalf of the user, like looking up account info, and even start browsing alongside the user to show them how to do something, like a tour guide. It can also nudge users when they seem confused or frustrated. I love when I encounter Command Bar in websites. It's white labeled, but at this point I can tell right away. Command Bar already reaches more than 20 million end users with major customers like HashiCorp, Gusto, Freshworks, Sixth Sense, and more. See for yourself at commandbar.com/MOZ or follow the link in the show notes.
This somewhat relates to your post most recently on stability, where there's this paradox of or contradiction where, you know, we just had an assassination attempt. We just had some people call January 6th a coup attempt. So there's we had the protests of 2020, et cetera. There's sort of some extremity on both sides in the last few years. At the same time, we're also seem exhausted. You know, reported crime is down. And so in some ways it seems very unstable. In other ways, it seems not that it's stable, but that it's unlikely to have, you know, mass violence, because who's going to be doing the fighting? You know, people just want to fight behind their keyboards. They don't want to actually go out and fight.
Less so, certainly.
But yeah, and any reactions to how we should think about sort of the current state of stability and what would get us there?
I mean, I think Trump is a uniquely destabilizing figure. But perhaps in his old age, he will mellow out and, you know, simply yell at people crankily from his front porch with his cane. It's possible. It's possible he'll use the assassination attempt, even though it was by some random nut. And people said he talked up conservative stuff. He's obviously a gun nut. This was not a political assassination. And, you know, so people maybe Trump will use that as a pretext to just implement fascism and crack down on everybody as the Democrats fear. But I think it would be ill-advised to do that. I think that would turn the country really against his movement forever, and the backlash to that would sweep progressives back into power. I think that a better idea is for Trump to mellow and chill out and to, you know, to just be an elder statesman, you know, a second term. That would probably be smart. I don't think anyone's going to try to assassinate him again. But I could maybe, but I doubt it. But then I think that, so I don't think he's going to mellow out of fear of assassination, because it wasn't a politically motivated assassination. It instead, but I think he might mellow out just because, you know, the whole country's mellowing out, and because he's old, you know, he's really old. And as long as he's in power and he's safe from prosecution, you know, et cetera, and he can yell at the people who, he can settle all his old scores and stuff like that. I think other than that, his zeal for transforming the country might be different. Like, he was never, you know, his ideology was always just a patchwork of things he got mad at on CNN. And, you know, J.D. Vance and Josh Hawley and those guys will try to make a more cohesive ideology going forward, that they'll try to have take over the Republican Party from, you know, conservatism. And that will be a thing that happens. But I don't know that Trump is necessarily ideological. He's a personalistic sort of guy. He is his own movement. And ultimately, that's why I don't think America will become fascist. I think that's a fake fear, not an unreasonable fear. It's always good to worry about countries becoming fascist, because they have a tendency to. You know, I'm pessimistic about this. I think fascism is in some way a natural political pole that modern societies tend toward, right? Because we don't have kings, we don't have like stable oligarchies over time. And you know, democracy is usually good, and then occasionally periods of unrest happen when democracy feels bad, and at that time there's always the temptation to go with fascists. And I think we're right to be worried, but I'm less worried about American fascism than I was in 2017. I never thought it was likely, but I was more worried about it than I am now. I don't feel like the camps are coming. I don't think the camps are coming. The national mood is more chill. The Wall Street Journal, I just said some story of, like, you know, how people are just disgusted. They're exhausted. They're tuning the shit out. I think that's right. And I always make the analogy to the 70s. In the 70s, we had two old guys, one on the right, one on the left, who basically were nobody presidents, Ford and Carter. Right. We had do you know the old Yiddish word nebbish? Just means kind of like a nobody. Right. It just means kind of like the old Norse word nathing is the same word in a different language. But then, yeah, it's basically just some bland, gray, you know, unimportant kind of person, an NPC, right? It's an NPC. So we had two NPC presidents, Ford and Carter, right? Carter actually did a lot of great stuff, but his public personality was very NPC. And so it's possible that people will remember Biden and Trump too as NPC presidents, simply because of the mood of general exhaustion will define how they think about who's the president. Maybe. And honestly, that might be the best course of, that might be the best.
Yeah, I was going to say, that would be a good outcome, potentially.
A good outcome. The problem is, in the 70s and early 80s, we were facing an enemy who had feet of clay. The USSR was on the way out, and, you know, we did some things that were helpful in beating them, but you know, we did a military buildup under Reagan, which was good. We did, you know, we supported the Mujahideen, not the Taliban, actually. We supported the Northern Alliance Mujahideen, who later became our allies in Afghanistan again. We supported them against Russia, and that was great. You know, we that was good. People are like, oh, it was blowback. No, we didn't support the Taliban, man. We supported the same guys in 2001 that we'd supported in 1978 or whatever, right? We did things to defeat the Soviet Union, but mostly they defeated themselves just by sucking, right? They couldn't build shit. They had this collapsing, incompetent economy, and they had ethnic tensions within their empire. The Ukrainians wanted out. The Baltics wanted out. The Kazakhs wanted out. The Uzbeks wanted out. Everybody wanted out of this dysfunctional Russian-ruled empire bullshit that the USSR had become, and or had always been, really. And so they got out, and so the USSR killed itself. And communism sucked. You know, if you really think communism sucks, you shouldn't need the United States to, like, do a massive military buildup in order to defeat it, right? Communism sucks. And so it died. And it died on its own, and we got away with passivity. The passivity of, you know, Ford and, like, Carter wasn't really that passive, but we didn't have the kind of vigorous national response to communism that we might have. Even Reagan's military buildup was relatively modest by historical standards, right? Like, you're not talking Korean War buildup level or even Vietnam level buildup. It was smaller than either of those. And so we made a big deal out of it. It looked like a thing, but it was less of a thing than people thought. It would have been enough to actually defeat the USSR. As we see now, the Russian weapons were not amazing. But anyway, now we have China. And China is much bigger than the USSR was. It is more technologically sophisticated. It has better companies. You know, like, China has sort of the you know, this is like, imagine the economic system of South Korea with the size of, you know, four times the Soviet Union. We're facing a four times Soviet Union who's actually good, much better at building shit. That's terrifying. They don't have as many nukes. And, you know, but they're not as ideological. They're just like, they're much sneakier in terms of getting popular support around the world. Well, they're not sneakier. The Soviet Union is sneakier, but China is like more canny. You know, they're wiser than the USSR was. And so, no, we're, the thing is, if during this interregnum where the United States calms down from the 2010s, that's the exact same. Those are the late 2020s. We have America basically exhausted, paralyzed, you know, by the legacy of unrest, if not current unrest, right? Just absolute American exhaustion. We've got the fact that our military modernization hasn't happened yet. We've got massive fiscal pressures for austerity, right? At the same time that China is at the peak of its power right now. Aging hasn't really kicked in yet. In China, the full effects of the real estate bust will eventually weaken the Chinese economy, but by draining growth out of things, that will drain demand, and that will ultimately slow down and weaken the Chinese economy over the course of decades. You know, like in the 2030s, probably. But that hasn't fully hit yet, right? China's still managing to keep a lot of it going with the massive subsidies for the, you know, car industry and the machine tool industry and the chip industry, right? They're still managing to keep some stuff going, and their ability to do that will be constrained because local governments have not been bailed out. The central government will have to bail everybody out, and then that'll make it take on a ton of debt, which will eventually crimp its ability to do stuff. And the weakness of the Chinese economic model will become apparent. It's actually weaker than the Japanese economic model was, but it's big, right? So, but that'll happen in the 2030s, right? In the 2030s, China's economy will be weakened. U.S. military modernization will progress, and the United States will sort of hopefully recover some of its self-confidence and vigor after this period of exhaustion in the 2030s. It's 6 years till the 2030s. In that time, China at the peak of its powers will be facing America at the peak of its exhaustion. So this is a very, very dangerous time. It's a very dangerous 6 years to be alive.
And we're what looks like about to have a reality TV show president, reality star president again. So
I would say it's more that the presidency has become a reality show than that the person who's in charge of reality show has become the president. So good luck. These will be as scary as hell rest of the decade. Like the rest of this decade will not be fun. The 2030s will hopefully be fun. If we do things right and we avoid a massive catastrophe in the short term, the 2030s will be a fun decade. We can make it to that, right? Those will be the new 80s. We'll get all the new fun stuff. We'll all just like play a bunch of Dungeons and Dragons and like watch anime and like listen to new wave music and go to punk rock shows and invent cool new drugs.
And repeat why we have to wait. Why do we have to wait till 2030s? What's happening then that won't happen in 2027?
Oh, because exhaustion will run its course. You know, the sort of tail end of people will realize that the danger of like woke cancellation is gone, so they'll be able to like do creative, funny, original stuff again in public. The you know, alt-right stuff will be discredited to the point where, you know, it's already discredited. It's, you know, you don't see a lot of alt-right people. Like, there's no Charlottesville Nazis marching now, right? The Proud Boys, they fucked off, whatever. But people will stop being scared of fascism. And so there'll be, you know, patriotism will be on an upswing. If we do things right, if we don't get our ass kicked by China, patriotism will be on an upsurge because we'll have the, what's it called? The 250-year sesquicentennial, maybe? It's the, I don't remember whether that's it, but we'll have the 250-year anniversary of America is coming up in 2 years. That will, like 1976, that will remind Americans that they like America. We'll be waving the flag in the 2030s. If we do things right and don't get our ass kicked by China and fall apart, we will be waving the flag in the 2030s. It'll be great. We have to make it to then so that America recovers from its exhaustion. And because China will start showing a lot of its weaknesses. China's on the clock, right? Aging will kick in much later. It'll start slightly eroding China's power in the 2030s and 2040s, but in the 2050s, it'll be a big problem. But the big thing is that China's catch-up growth is over, and it's kind of like, you know, Roadrunner runs off the cliff, and then Wile E. Coyote runs off the cliff and like then looks around and is like, oh, shit, and then he falls. Well, China's economy has sort of done that. They're still in the air, right? But they've run off the cliff in terms of the real estate crash. That knocked the foundation out of there. You know, manufacturing isn't going to replace that. Manufacturing is good. It's fine. It's not going to replace what real estate was to the Chinese economy. So that's what's up. So the 2030s and U.S. military modernization will also help stabilize the situation in the Pacific. China knows all these things I'm telling you. Whoever they've got watching this podcast, they probably have one guy watching this podcast because they have like high unemployment. So they've got to provide jobs for people. They know everything I just said to you. They know that Trump, too, is their golden opportunity to make their big break and break out and take over Asia and, by extension, the world. And so that's what we're facing over the next 6 years. It will be a very difficult time, and we don't necessarily have the optimal people leading. Maybe J.D. Vance can do something.
Well, Trump does have a 22% chance of dying, according to just the actual actuarial tables for someone his age. But Trump seems to be invincible to impervious to death in some ways. So,
I mean, Biden,
right?
You know, Biden got COVID several times. He's, you know, he went mentally downhill. But Trump is kind of going mentally downhill too. But physically, okay. Yeah, no, like I wish Trump were gone from politics. I wish Trump were sir not appearing in this film. You know, I'd rather Vance as president than Trump. I'd rather have Kamala Harris as president than Trump. She'd do a bad job. Trump would do a bad job. But because, you know, her advisors would take over everything, and they do a bunch of like dumb woke, you know, and progressive shit, but they also do a bunch of like smart stuff, the continuation of the Biden administration. So she'd be fine. Trump getting reelected is probably the worst political outcome that could happen, other than maybe him getting assassinated and, you know, some actual civil war happening or something. But like, so I'm glad he didn't get assassinated, obviously, but like be an asshole to say, oh, I wish he had. But no, I am glad he didn't get assassinated because that would have caused a lot more recriminations. And that might have caused the like witch hunts and purges and stuff like that. I think now that the fact that he didn't get assassinated, the fact that it failed, means it will probably be memory hold much more than if he had just gotten shot in the head. He's not a martyr. He got hit by a piece of glass on his ear, but he's not a martyr. And so that's good, right? That's good. And but it's bad that we're going to get him as president. This is bad. It's bad for our country. He, you know, like, he's not like, anyway. But the question is, will it be bad enough to sink us? Maybe. I'm very worried. I think other people should be worried. And they, you know, all the tech people who maybe hopefully some of them watch this podcast.
They do, I'm sure.
I'm probably not the, like, you know, I'm sure that the top guys don't have time to watch this podcast. Maybe they read an opinion. But the point is that these guys should use their newfound position within the Trump constellation to push Trump toward things like actually standing up to China, actually doing industrial policy, you know, like, you know, in a smart way. You know, they should push Trump to do these important and necessary things, you know, allies, trade with allies. That's the thing we need to do. Maybe the tech people can inject some actual sense and intelligence into the Trump movement. So maybe entryism is the key, because we've certainly seen people enter the progressive movement and run it into the ground, right? Yeah, so we've seen people, entryism can work.
Yeah, in both directions. We should, at some point, we should get, I don't know if Joe Lonsdale or whoever from the tech right is the right person to have on, but we should have someone on who has ties to this administration if they in fact win.
All right, you're on that. That's your job. I actually do know Joe, but I think they'll listen to you more than me.
I'll get someone. On that note, we're a bit over time, but this was a great episode. Noah, as always, until next time.
Until next time.
Econ 102 is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Moment of Zen, In the Arena, The Cognitive Revolution, and more. If you like what you hear, subscribe and leave us a review in the App Store. You can keep up with both of our Substacks for written analysis of the topics we cover in the show at noahopinion.substack.com and erictornberg.substack.com. Thanks for listening.
If you liked the episode you just heard, it may be worth checking out another Turpentine podcast called History 102. Every week, YouTube creator Rudyard Lynch, the historian behind What If Alt Hist, dives into one critical historical topic. Check out episodes on classical Greece, early America, ancient China, the fall of the Roman Empire, and more. Our goal is to cover as many historical topics in depth and still be the most fun history lesson you've ever had. Subscribe at the link in the description.